Welcome to Film Weekly with me, Jason Solomons. On this week's show, we look forward to Boxing Day's release of a hotly anticipated John Lennon biopic, Nowhere Boy. I talk to one of its stars, Anne-Marie Duff, as she takes on the role of John Lennon's wayward mother, Julia. Zan Brooks and I will be reviewing the much-hyped Avatar. Is it the future? And does it work? Also, we'll be reviewing Daniel Day-Lewis in 9 and what happens when two straight guys make the ultimate dare in Hump Day. Also, the Golden Globe nominations are out. Zan and I will look at the list like fortune tellers into a glass ball, looking for future awards and Oscar winners amongst the nominees. Yes, right now, it's bigger than Jesus. It's Film Weekly. Artist-turned-director Sam Taylor-Wood's debut Nowhere Boy is guaranteed a wide audience for no reason other than its subject matter is the formative years of a British icon, John Lennon. Although tracing Lennon's emergence as a musical force, the film is chiefly an exploration of the young Lennon's relationships with his strict aunt Mimi, who raised him, and his wayward mother Julia, who enters his life in his teens, bringing joy and sorrow to the young John. Julia is superbly played by Anne-Marie Duff, one of the finest British actresses, best known for her role perhaps as Fiona Gallagher in the TV series Shameless, but fast building a superb career on the big screen. I spoke to Anne-Marie Duff about playing an icon's mum, but first let's hear a clip of her and Aaron Johnson as the young Lennon in action in Nowhere Boy.
Hold it like this. Arm, horizontal from the elbow, strum from the wrist. Think Bo Diddley.
Strum from the wrist.
John, be serious, or I'll phone Mimi myself. Now, just strum. Try and hit all the strings.
Who's Maggie May?
A whore. Now, if you're here, you might as well learn something. Your turn.
And Anne-Marie Duff joins me on the line now. Welcome to Film Weekly, Anne-Marie.
Thank you very much.
How lovely to have you. It's great to have you on Film Weekly rather than on, like, Telly Weekly or Stage Weekly.
Yeah, I guess so. I like to do all kinds of different things, so it's nice for me. I'm one of the lucky actors, you know. I get to visit every different medium, so I'm really lucky.
Because you've had a bit of a run film-wise. I mean, I think most people would know you, I suppose, from Shameless, and then the stage folk would know you from your Nora in A Doll's House, and many other kind of great ones, and Maria Stewart, of course. But you've had a recent run of things like The Waiting Room and Is Anybody There and French Film, and now Nowhere Boy, of course, in which you've got this wonderful part of Julia. So it's a nice run of British films that you're able to stretch out into.
No, I know it, and I mean, it's the drawback with working on low budget British films is that not many people get to see them. But when you work on a project like Nowhere Boy, because of the subject matter, it has such a huge mass appeal, so it's a very different experience, you know.
Did you know that going into it? I mean, obviously you knew it was the story of the teenage John Lennon, so there was that audience built in, but it was still never sure because Sam Taylor Wood's first time director, Aaron Johnson's not that well known as a star. Did you know that it was going to be a sort of fairly big project in the end?
Well, I felt like it might have some shine to it, in as much as Matt Greenhalgh's screenplay, you know, because of the success of Control. And also Sam will arouse a certain interest. People will be curious to see what an artist can achieve, especially on the back of Steve McQueen's success. So I think in that way you kind of knew, but you just from an actor's point of view, you have to try and not even remotely think about that, because so many films don't even get to distribution stage, do they? So you just have to try and concentrate on the process.
Yeah, absolutely. Really. What did you think going to work for Sam Taylor Wood? I mean, obviously, you know, when I knew she was doing this, I'd seen her short film, actually. So I thought, well, perhaps it won't be like her, you know, her art installations and her pictures of men sleeping. What did you think that you were going to get involved in? Did you think you would be in something, you mentioned Steve McQueen, something as sort of artistically bold and sort of groundbreaking as Hunger? Because in the end, Nowhere Boy, and I think part of the joy of it is that it isn't a kind of rigorous art exercise at all. It's a very tenderly told film.
No, I know it is quite traditional, actually, the result. But, I guess I just thought, well, perhaps you'll be terribly lateral-minded and I'll be challenged in a completely different way. When I met her, when we first talked about the film, I met her at the White Cube Gallery, so already I felt slightly out of my comfort zone.
So for sort of the casting, she says, come down the White Cube.
Yeah, exactly. So that was, so for me it was already a very different experience. I was surrounded by people who didn't have the sensitivity that we all have and take it for granted. So it was, it was curious to begin with. And then, but then very quickly I realised that she has an enormous, amount of empathy generally for other human beings. And so in terms of storytelling, that's just, that's a huge bonus, so you're already halfway there, really.
Yeah, absolutely. And I suppose that's what an actor needs to do, because you've got to play Julia. Tell us about Julia herself, because she's this kind of mythical figure in the Lennon canon, I suppose, in British pop music history as well. Without being part of it, she's been very much influential in it. Tell her about the way you approach the character, because the way you play her, she's, she's kind of fiery, she's a bit mad, she's sexy, she's enchanting, she's all of those things. She's also rather dangerous.
Yeah, I guess she's the piece of the jigsaw that's missing, really, isn't she? And so, therefore, she becomes hugely enigmatic. And it's very difficult. You feel the pressure when you're playing roles like that, especially when it comes to Lennon, because Lennon fans are generally quite obsessive in their knowledge of his life.
Yes.
So they can tell you everything. But my lucky thing was that she was rather underrepresented in all the biographies, apart from Julia Baird's book, Julia being her daughter and John's half-sister. So, I was quite lucky and I had a wee bit of freedom. I didn't have to adhere so much to somebody else's version. You know, I could just be a bit more creative. But I took events and I took snippets of information from Julia's book that kind of gave me clues as to her character. And then Matt had created this sort of irresistible, complicated, flame-haired, broken-hearted woman, so for me, I just sort of had to jump in and say, well, I will create as real an individual as I can, adhering to what his idea is, but make her as, not make her grotesque, but just make her as true to that notion as possible.
What about Julia's story? You had to get inside the head of a woman who gives away her son. That's an extraordinary kind of place to be. It's almost classical, isn't it?
It really is, actually. It does have... So it's very heightened reality she lives in. It's a different time, We exist in this sort of culture of optimism when it comes to keeping kids with their parents in spite of everything, sometimes to tragic consequences now. But back in the day, people really did take children away from parents if they thought it was for the best. It was much more of a culture of that in this country, and so it was ghastly and awful, and it wounded her for life.
Mm. And it wounded John for life as well, I suppose.
Obviously the repercussions on the child are even worse, I suspect, But he was lucky that he had this incredible woman, Mimi, and that they did actually reconnect before she died. That was an enormous blessing, I think.
Yeah, absolutely, and I suppose that's why we've got this film, that's why we've got the songs, that's why we've got why we've got the Beatles, maybe.
She made him play music, and it's sort of astonishing, that, really.
Yeah, there's the lovely scene where you're teaching him to strum the ukulele.
The banjo. He started off on the banjo, because, of course, skiffle was all the rage, wasn't it, at that time?
Yeah, so can you play the banjo?
I had to learn quite a few songs for the film. We didn't use them all because, so much gets cut, but yeah.
Really? So there's Anne-Marie Duff strumming on the banjo on the cutting room floor somewhere?
Somewhere, me doing a George Formby impression.
Really?
Somewhere.
Are you any good?
I thought I was rather good.
Go on, give us a bit of George.
No, no, never again. Never to be repeated.
Oh, no, do you know what? It's going to be on those DVD deleted scenes thing.
It will be. Because it's very funny. Then, I hope it is on there.
Then you can be on, they don't have stars in your eyes anymore. Tonight, Matthew, I'm going to be George
Formby. Tonight, Matthew, I'm going to be giving my best George Formby.
Yeah, I think you'll be brilliant. You're managing to be in also other films at the moment, including The Last Station, Anne-Marie, which is getting awards pressure. I know you've just won a BIFFA, which is brilliant, as a supporting actress to playing Julia. But the film that you're in, Last Station, in which you're starring at last alongside James McAvoy, but Christopher Plummer, Helen Mirren, they're all getting kind of Golden Globe nominations.
I know, very exciting news yesterday. It's lovely, especially for Christopher, I feel, because his performance is so beautiful in the film.
Now, I haven't seen this film. What is it?
It's about the last year of Leo Tolstoy's life. There was this novel, another version of events, but it very much in novel form, by Jay Perini, and about the time of that time of his life. And Christopher plays himself, and Helen plays his wife. I play his daughter,
Sasha.
Yes, yeah, Sasha. So it's good. It's a bit like a bonkers old theatre piece put on the film. It has a real, real sense of the Russian about it, and I love it. It's a very, very charming.
Did you get to wear fur hats?
No.
Oh, you want to insist?
I was looking for some and a muff. None were to be found.
No, Anne-Marie Muff. That would have been perfect. The headlines I can see now in the Daily Mail online. It would have been brilliant. I know when Keira Knightley did Dr. Zhivago, she insisted on a furry hat. Looked wonderful in it.
Yeah, she did look very cute.
Yeah, you see, you want to be insisting on your wardrobe, Anne-Marie. Look, not for me to teach an actress how to get a rider up, but that's what you want. Was it nice to act with James?
Yeah, he's a wonderful actor, so I love to watch him work and work with him. He's a very generous actor as well to be with. And just in the way that you always want to work with brilliant people.
Yeah. And also, I think people will have just seen you in Margot on the telly as well, as Margot Fonteyn. What a fantastic performance, may I say. I don't get to watch a lot of telly, but this one had it's the story of the ballerina. Or a ballerina, do I call her a ballerina? Yeah,
yeah.
I suppose so. Margot
She's
Fonteyn.
She's the first British ballerina, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And did you have to, much as you learned the banjo to play Julia,
yeah,
did you have to learn the ballet, or is that something you trained for as a young
Anne-Marie? No, I was an absolute... I was like a brickie in boots when I walked into the rehearsal room. I had to spend 6 weeks working incredibly hard. I had brilliant teachers, the ballet boys who used to be with the Royal Ballet and now have their own company and choreograph and make films about dance. So they were perfect. And then we had
I assumed that you were like this little girl ballerina who hadn't done it for years.
Oh, no, not even. I was such a tomboy. I was the opposite of that. So, yeah.
Right, and you had Otto Barthurst, who's a brilliant, I think, up-and-coming director.
Oh, gosh, he's a real director to watch. I mean, he was so ambitious with what he did with that film. He did things that you wouldn't see on telly normally, so... And he's just a joy to work with. I can't wait to see what happens with him.
Well, I think it's very interesting because watching that one, you thought, well, that had a really filmic sensibility. And in a way, TV and film, they're getting so mixed now. And I say that you kind of mix the two, TV and film. But do you know when you're going into a film, whether it's a film that's a TV film? Because, Nowhere Boy's going to be on TV, let's face it, in a year's time as well. Mm. And it shouldn't lose anything in the translation, one hopes. Or is there a different acting for when you're doing big screen versus small screen acting?
I don't think there is there really? It's just all about truth, isn't it? And I think we're really lucky in this country. We don't have those divisions. There's no snobbery about it. You watch Dame Judi Dench in Cranford. She'll be on Sunday night, and then she'll have some big movie coming out, Nine.
Yeah.
We're so lucky that we don't have that, you can only be one kind of actor attitude in this country, and it's brilliant.
Well, when I watch you, Anne-Marie, I always think, you're so wonderful to watch, but I never kind of know... who to compare you to. Do you have a role model? I know you say, well, of course I'm my own person, but you must have had heroes or heroines, I suppose, growing up wanting to be an actress. Is there someone whose path you'd like to follow, or someone whose technique you particularly admire?
There are several. I'm so lucky. There's lots of, but when I was very wee, I suppose I was slightly obsessed with Meryl Streep because she was right at that point of, it was a real sort of heyday for her, wasn't it?
The Kramer versus Kramer. Well, you're going to show your age now. The Kramer versus Kramer, Sophie's Choice.
And then it's Sophie's Choice, yeah, because I just thought she was just so incredible. And she does have a sort of chameleon-like quality, which I find very interesting, without it being about all putty noses and, bonkers voices. I think it's fascinating. But then, now I just think Penelope Wilton is one of the greatest actresses in this country. And, you know, there are so many role models, really.
Because you can take yours from those who have stage careers, TV careers and film careers as well. You know, what's going to happen with Nowhere Boy is that maybe it'll go on the awards circuit and you'll end up meeting Meryl Streep. You'll end up sitting next to Meryl Streep at some awards.
God knows, although sometimes it's not good to meet your heroes.
But I think you'll find she's probably quite cool. You'll be all right with that one.
I suspect she would be, actually, yeah.
Anne Marie Duff, I wish you the best of luck when you do get to meet Meryl Streep, not to go all knock-kneed and like, I think you'll be self-composed and brilliant because your performances on screen always suggest that. It's a brilliant performance as Julia. I was so glad that you won at the Biffers. It was delightful,
Jason.
Great for the film. I wish it the best of luck when it opens on Boxing Day and best of continued luck for you in your career. And I'm sure this will not be the last time we have you on Film Weekly, my dear.
Thanks, Jason. Thank you so much.
Now, in a collaboration worthy of Lennon and McCartney, Zan Brooks from The Guardian joins me to review some of the week's releases. Welcome back, Zan. Nice to see you.
Thank you, and happy Christmas.
Thank you very much. Happy Hanukkah to you. You've just been to Germany for the European Film Awards.
I did, yes. I was in the lovely city of Essen.
Ah, sunny Essen.
Which is very like Coventry, except full of German speakers.
Michael Haneke's The White Ribbon cleaned up at the IFAs this year, did it not?
It did, yes. I think it was being seen as a two-horse race between that and Un Prophet. And in the end, I think Tahir Rahim won the Best Actor Award for Un Prophet, but everything else seemed to go to Haneke.
Yeah, it's been like that since Cannes, hasn't it? Those two have been jostling and sort of one.
Yeah, that seems to be the consensus, that those are the two heavyweight foreign language films from this year.
Yeah, and I noticed they're both nominated for Golden Globes. I think they probably could be nominated both at the Oscars as well. And even maybe break out of that foreign language mode, certainly Un Prophet, into bigger picture, kind of into best film kind of categories.
I wonder. I think the Academy is famously reluctant to do that.
But they've got 10 pictures to do it this year.
They have, you're right.
It might just anoint
Jacques Audiard.
You know I'm a big fan of that one. Well, both of them, indeed. We'll be talking about those a bit later on as well. But for this week, we'll be reviewing James Cameron's Avatar with its digital trickery and huge budget and large glasses. Daniel Day-Lewis in a musical in Nine. And we'll be keeping it indie with Hump Day, two heterosexual males making the ultimate dare. We won't go that far, Zan, but we will start with James Cameron.
The night is young, Jason.
You never know. We look at James Cameron's Avatar. Put on your spectacles, Zan. For here we have a clip of the most expensive film made ever, ever, ever. Well, at least since James Cameron's last one. Here's the head of security welcoming the recruits to hell.
You are not in Kansas anymore. You are on Pandora, ladies and gentlemen. Respect that fact. Every second of every day. If there is a hell, you might want to go there for some R&R after a tour on Pandora.
That's actually in the sort of real life bit. So Cameron may not need a pitch, but the Film Weekly listener does. Tell me what on earth this is about.
Okay, well, this is Sam Northington as a paraplegic marine about 100 years hence, at a time when the Earth is mining for minerals on this sort of verdant rainforest planet. And he is conjured into an avatar, a mix of himself and this towering blue alien, to go to this planet where he goes native and falls in love with a native girl.
Quite hot native girl.
A very hot native girl, but a little tall for us, I think.
First time I've kind of thought,
sleep with an alien.
Sleep with someone with a tail, at least. So is the money on the screen in Avatar?
I think it is. In terms of actual logic or dialogue, it's really not there at all. In terms of spectacle, it is there. And by God, it has to be, with the amount of money that they've sunk into this, with the advance word that this is the future of cinema that we're seeing. And I suspect that it probably is. It probably is a strain of cinema that we will see more of. It looks fantastic. The 3D landscapes do look wonderful. And I think, to Cameron's credit, he doesn't just have it as tableaus to stare at. He does kind of inject action. He has the great action set pieces playing out in these landscapes, which makes it feel more organic and brings you into it, so, to the extent that you forget to think, oh, look, those flower petals are in the foreground and the trees in the
absolutely
background.
Absolutely. It isn't a 3D the way, you know, like Kiss Me, Kate, where, you know, she Pamela kicks off her shoes and then they come flying towards you. Or it isn't even My Bloody Valentine 3D, where body parts spurt towards you. It's sort of, you forget that it's 3D. So what's the big deal with the 3D?
Well, I think the big deal with the 3D is, I mean, isn't that the ultimate achievement of every magic trick, to make you forget about the magic? That's not to say that I thought it was a great film necessarily, but it certainly wasn't a film that made me just sit there thinking, oh, look, I'm admiring the technique. And I think thrown in here, there's a typical Cameronian confusion between what he's actually trying to say. That there's a lot of kind of eco-blathering.
Yeah, isn't there?
A hell of a lot of that, but then also a hell of a lot of, let's just shoot things up, let's just have loads of explosions. So he's trying to have it both ways, and he's a purely conflicted filmmaker.
This is like going into a health food shop in Brighton and then trashing the place.
Yes, it is like that, isn't it?
It's just like going out.
Coming out with a henna tattoo and an Uzi.
Yeah, so nicking some beans, mung beans, and saying, yeah, cheers, I'm not paying for it, I'm going to blow you all up.
Yeah, it is.
Well, I mean, I suppose there's an element of the Lost World about it. There's an element of what Jackson was trying to do with King Kong.
There is all that, and I guess it is. It's the parable of the founding of America, I guess, isn't it, really? I think that's Cameron's grandiose aim with this.
And
this
yet he's slightly D.W. Griffith about the whole thing. He's got a Birth of the Nation strain, I don't want to taint him with any racism. I'm sure that's not there. But in the way Titanic, which I thought was, you know, a titanically rubbish film.
Yeah.
But by the time the hype gets kind of put on it and it sinks under the weight of its 12 Oscars, you suddenly think, well, my God, he's onto something here in the popular imagination.
Yeah, yeah.
There must be something he's tapping into that I'm not getting. And in the end, you can sort of see Titanic, maybe that's the hopes and fears of a nation. It's man's hubris. And that you could do the same with Avatar. It's all there. Except I just don't think he sort of tells you where it is. But I think you can sort of bring everything to it. I don't know about Avatar. I sort of didn't hate it.
I didn't hate it.
But I should have.
I think we probably both should have, but it's just made with enough gusto and conviction that it does carry you along.
Well, let's see what we can do with another genre film. I suppose it's the musical, which has been reinvigorated by Rob Marshall, who, of course, brought us Chicago. He's back this week with Nine, which is the last screenplay by Anthony Minghella. It has Daniel Day-Lewis and a cast of 1,000 beautiful women, including Sophia Loren, Judi Dench, Nicole Kidman, Penelope Cruz, and Fergie from The Black Eyed Peas. In this clip we're going to hear, we have got Penelope Cruz enticing Guido, played by Daniel Day-Lewis, the Italian director, and she's going to be making him an offer I think he'd find very difficult to refuse.
Guido, don't die on me, can you imagine? Poor Luigi, he would kill him.
If I die, it would kill your husband.
No, that's not what I meant, Guidino, no. Where are you going?
I have to go to work. Carla, I can't breathe.
Let me come with you.
It's impossible.
Why?
Because it's impossible, please.
But why is it impossible? Guido, everybody knows about me. Why? Why won't you let me near you?
For the very same reason you don't want me to die on top of you. It's not fair to your husband. It's not fair to my wife.
Please let me come with you.
No.
I'll be here waiting for you. My legs open.
Penelope Cruz there in, I must say, a role that I can only describe as Scorchio. Very, very, very hot.
Jason, I think we're talking at utter cross purposes here. I found that scene, fortunately, I think you can't actually see that scene. Now, I bow to no man in my admiration for Penelope Cruz, but here Rob Marshall, the director, has her writhing on a bed in brocade negligee and fishnets, basically grinding her buttocks into the camera. And weirdly, it is one of the most unerotic scenes I've ever seen Penelope Cruz play.
I couldn't help thinking, that's Penelope Cruz. What are you doing? Is it not that she's the sort of a figment of Daniel Day-Lewis's Italian id and ego and rampant kind of sexuality? Isn't that what
that
this
doesn't film's
excuse
about? It? Does it not? You think that's what they told her?
That's how I think he gets away with it.
I thought that this scene probably epitomised all that I hate about this film. I really dislike.
You
this
really
film
hated it
intensely.
Yeah, I quite liked it. I didn't mind it at
Why?
All. But I mean, I love Italian movies and Fellini, and I love kind
this
of
wasn't
musicals.
Fellini. This was I don't know, this is like this sort of cavorting turkey, screeching feathered turkey.
Do you really think so? It's that bad? Is it because you don't like musicals? You generally don't mind
well,
a musical.
Yeah, no, I have to say I don't particularly like musicals, and that I worry that I'm unqualified to see this film. So
not
to go to see a film like this is almost like, it's like having an organised trip to an abattoir with a load of butchers, and they all sit there and they say, oh, look at the brilliant way they've cut up that pig. And I'm just sitting there thinking, oh, that's just disgusting. And that was the problem that I had with this. I thought, this film is not for me. But even having said that, I think this is a particularly bad musical. I think the songs are bad. And I just didn't damn care about it.
So many people don't like it. I mean, I don't like Rob Marshall as a director at all. Mm. I thought Memoirs of a Geisha was an abomination, a horrific piece of work. And I hated Chicago, which is a musical I actually like. I hated what he did to it. I'd never really heard of Nine. It had a sort of reasonably successful off-Broadway run. And it's about the Fellini trying to make 8.5 and trying to get into his head. This film is nothing like that. Of course, it's not about Fellini, really, as you say.
No.
But it does quote from Italian neorealism in the kind of most glib way. I quite enjoyed it, what it was doing. I quite enjoyed the kind of tortured kind of preening of Daniel Day-Lewis. Quite enjoyed each girl turning up as a kind of egoist advert for the finest days of Chanel No. 5.
I just hated them all, and I didn't care. He's like, Daniel Day-Lewis is basically playing Guido Contini, who's the Italian maestro, who cannot make his film. He cannot make it.
No,
he's got the women all around him, and he doesn't know which women to pick. And I just didn't give a damn.
I don't have a problem with that. I was watching the September issue the other week.
Well, Cannes is your natural home.
Well, you see, this is it. Maybe I just live in a Fellini circus clown with women with huge breasts and propensity to mime.
Well, okay.
And that is Nine, on which we're begging to differ.
Can I just quote a line from it? I think
it's got
some of the worst lyrics as well. It's Marion Cotillard as Daniel Day-Lewis's wife, explaining what it's like to be married to this great director. And she says, like Michelangelo, he paints his private dome, but he can't distinguish what's his work and what's his home.
If Cole Porter had written that, you'd be saying it's brilliant.
No, I wouldn't.
It reminded me of Woody Allen's Stardust Memories when they kept going on about his early films. Anyway, we can argue about Nine, and we will, and we have. But let's move to, I suppose, the smallest, tiniest film that's the opposite of Avatar, the opposite of Nine, a no-budget US indie called Hump Day. We had the director on, Lynn Shelton, when her film opened Rain Dance here in the UK back in October. Here's a clip of Ben and Andrew discussing their great plan for an artistic installation.
I get it, and look, we've known each other a long fucking time, and like I said last night, you know, like, we've got really fucking different lives now.
It's true.
And I get that in the paradigm in which you live, these weird conversations are not things that are really appropriate, and that, you know, that I don't think any less of you for it, that, you know, that,
Well, first of all, let's just, like, Take this down just a second. You're not as Kerouac as you think you are, even though you've got the headband on, and I'm not as white picket fence as you think I am, okay? Like, the black and whites in which you're thinking this is a little bit extreme, okay?
Look, I'm saying it's an awesome idea for an art project, right. But I understand...
I think it's an awesome idea, too.
Yeah, but I understand that it's not something that you can really do in your station.
That's kind of what I have a problem with.
Zan, this is I suppose, from the mumblecore school, but, it, you know, will this ever get 3D? It doesn't need to be 3D, this kind of proves everything that Avatar is saying, that the future of cinema, it's not going to influence things like Hump Day, is it?
Well, God. I don't know. I mean, considering that they're planning to make a piece of gay pornography, I think 3D could only enhance that, couldn't it?
I mean, there is something interesting about the form of this, because it is shot on very lo-fi video. You could have done it on your mobile phone at home, sort of thing. Does the aesthetic of this get in the way of it? Does it enhance it? How do you feel about this?
I think this enhanced it. I'm not a big fan of mumblecore generally, but I thought that this was a very good example of it.
Absolutely.
And it completely brought me in, and I believed in these two characters, who are, you know, in some ways the typical buddy bromance characters. There's the guy who's settled down, and then the guy who's a bit of a wild free spirit still. So they're kind of archetypes. But within that, I thought that the acting was very good, and the scenario was believable.
It's a kind of good scenario, isn't it? I mean, it could be a very high concept movie. I think I discussed that with Lynn Shelton on the show, that you could see sort of Matt Dillon doing the friend who settled down, and then kind of Luke Wilson comes in, or Owen Wilson. Vince Vaughn comes in, a guy, he's been travelling around, and he says, hi bro, let me stay with you for a bit, and the wife doesn't like him anymore, and he says, well, I know, let's make a gay porn movie, that'll kind of really test our buddy friendship out. And that's essentially what this film is. It builds up to them kind of going to a hotel and sort of putting their own video camera and filming themselves trying to make a gay porn movie for a sort of, what is it, it's a San Francisco or a Portland,
it's
a local
Seattle,
art festival,
I think. It's
Portland,
a sort of
Oregon,
yes,
or something like that.
It's a Pacific Northwest art festival where they're trying to reclaim pornography as art, aren't we all?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. The joy of this, and we can speak quite freely amongst friends here, Zan, is seeing two men with their tops off trying to kiss each other and thinking, oh, I don't know if this is a good idea.
Well, I mean, this is what makes it interesting in that, you know, it takes the sort of bromance genre and pushes it to its logical conclusion. And there's an argument that you could say that all formative male friendships are basically homosexual in nature. Mm. And the inevitable consequence of prolonging your youth and leading this kind of slacker lifestyle is that that tension is never resolved. And this is a film that is purely about that. And it does it with humour and wit and superb observation.
And I mean, I particularly like the photography in this that is so kind of close up and kind of unadorned and natural lit as well, because it does make them, when they take their tops off, these men, you're just going, oh, no. I mean, thank God women find us attractive in some way. I mean, you're lucky enough to have found someone who found you attractive. And I too have done that. exactly. But, you know, if no offence, mate, but if you were taking your top off now, I mean, Dan, don't do it.
No, it's not the Christmas party yet.
Best performance by an actor in a supporting role in a motion picture. Matt Damon, Invictus. Woody Harrelson, The Messenger. Christopher Plummer, The Last Station. Stanley Tucci, The Lovely Bones. And Christoph Waltz for Inglourious Basterds. Yay!
That was Diane Kruger there, the star of Inglourious Basterds, taking great pleasure in announcing her co-star Christoph Waltz as a nominee for the Best Performing Actor in a Supporting Role award at the 67th Golden Globes, the nominations for which were announced this week. The full nominee lists were out. They're online. Check them out. Zan, what do you make of these, the first big nominations of awards season?
I think this is a pretty depressing lineup. It's odd, isn't it? Until a couple of years ago, the Globes were seen as the classier end of the awards spectrum, and the Oscars were kind of crass and showbiz. And yet the pyramid has sort of flipped really in the last couple of years. And this is the real Broadway. This is the Broadway Film Awards, and it's all a little bit trashy.
It's
I think.
Bit. I mean, Sandra Bullock's got two nominations for Best Actress: one in drama, one in comedy. I mean, the world's gone mad.
It really has. It's a pretty paltry lineup. I mean, The Hurt Locker, yes. Precious, yes. But you know, Avatar and Glorious Bastards up in the air, really not. And then in the musical or comedy, The Hangover I liked.
Yeah, I mean, as comedies go, that was one of the year's better comedies. Yeah. But I mean, it's never going to get nominated at the Oscars or any, I don't think, any serious awards.
Similar deal with the actors. I mean, Carey Mulligan for An Education, I would agree with. I think that she was wonderful in that. Helen Mirren in The Last Station. The Last Station is not a good film, and she is bad in it.
Really? Oh, Anne-Marie Duff didn't say that, but she wouldn't.
No, of course she wouldn't. And actually, Anne-Marie Duff, if there's anybody who should be nominated for The Last Station, it's Anne-Marie
Duff. She should be nominated most of the time.
She's great.
She's never been bad.
You know, yes, Colin Firth for A Single Man, absolutely.
Yes.
Morgan Freeman in Invictus, no.
Really? Is that really not? I haven't seen that yet. I mean, no. He plays Nelson Mandela, who sort of unites South Africa with Matt Damon playing rugby. Yeah. Sounds dreadful.
It is dreadful. It's all that you're imagining it will be. It's Mandela as all-seeing and wise and wonderful.
Is it him sort of... like the bloke from Shawshank Redemption, he's escaped.
Yeah,
Robin
he's
Island.
Escaped. Yeah, now he's got some wisdom to impart,
and he's the god who can make penguins march all the way to the South Pole and get their eggs back.
Yeah,
god, amazing.
Yeah.
Amazing man.
I'm sort of glad to see Michael Stuhlbarg in for A Serious Man.
Oh, delighted as well.
Always
to see a Jew
happy to
up
see
there.
Julianne Moore, who's a Jew only in the first syllable of her name, but she's always good.
We'll let her in anyway. We'll take what we can get.
Penelope Cruz in Nine? No, again, no.
Nine to Penelope Cruz. Vera Farmiga, I was quite pleased to see in Up in the Air. People always say, oh, it's the Golden Globes. It's exciting. They're an indicator to the Oscar. So in some way, they only work as kind of concentrating people's minds towards the sort of more serious business of the Oscars. I think that's sort of a shame for the Golden Globes. And I think maybe...
It's the Globes' fault, though, when you get a list like this.
Yeah, well, I mean, they're famous for a sort of, isn't it, Pia Zadora? Who won an award there for Best Actress or something. They've done... I mean, interestingly in there is Inglourious Basterds. Christoph Waltz, yes, he won at Cannes for Best Actor. We've been saying his is a great performance. But I know she's been nominated for Best Film. Tarantino's been nominated, I think, for Best Director as well. This has surprised me.
It has surprised me. I think that the general consensus on that film was that it was a mess, that possibly an entertaining mess, but still
Absolutely.
A mess and therefore a failure. Now there seems to be a revisionism
Isn't
going
it?
On, and it's being seen as a heavyweight film and a real, you know, a contender. I don't think there's much mileage in that. I'd be surprised to see Inglourious Basterds figuring heavily in the Oscars.
Yeah, except it has that Jewish theme too, and we know there's no business like show a business. Although this kind of is almost sort of denies. I'm not saying he's a Holocaust denier, but it sort of puts that to the other side of it, doesn't it? It doesn't really talk about the Holocaust.
Not really. It just gives the Jews the guns and lets them run amok.
The other thing about the Golden Globes is they have a foreign language category. A Prophet and the White Ribbon, as we said before, are in there.
Yep.
Baria, the film which opened the Venice Film Festival, the Tornatorio's film, is in there, I noticed. I didn't see that film. You did.
I hated it. But I guess it is the Cinema Paradiso kick. It's Nine, but without the songs. It's what everyone wants Italians to be. It's big and bold, and everybody's shouting and throwing things at each other in kitchens. And it's bogus, but I think it plays well to an international audience.
Zan Brooks, that's the Golden Globes. There's many awards, a discussion to come in the next few months. We look forward to it. Zan, thank you for joining me today.
Thank you.
For the best awards coverage, not just of the Golden Globes, but of everything going on around the world in this hectic awards season, go to guardian.co.uk/film. That's all for Film Weekly this week. Pick up a copy of The Observer this Sunday, where my feature on the runners and riders for this year's Oscars will appear. The music featured on the show this week is from Avatar. It's by the composer James Horner, the man behind Titanic and Mel Gibson's Apocalypto, and Troy, of course. But for now, from me, Jason Solomons, and my producer, Jason Phipps, all the best for the season, and goodbye.